love this podcast? Support us by leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Hit the link in the episode description to support us now. Thanks for listening and enjoy. Do you know how to read tarot cards?
Not really, actually. I did buy a deck that's very similar to the one used in at least one of the films. And I have no idea what to fucking do with it. I'm like going through all the instructions and I'm like, okay, is this good? Is this bad? I don't know.
Eddie won't let me have a tarot card deck in our house. And I don't believe in that stuff, but I don't know. They seem fun.
Why won't he? Like, why can't you have tarot cards?
He feels
cards?
Like it's inviting the spirits, like with the Ouija boards.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well,
it is technically blasphemy.
If we associate with them with negative spirits, then yeah, maybe, I guess so.
I don't know. The Bible says, thou shalt not read the future, for I am the one true God, and only I know the future. I think it has to do with that.
There you go.
Don't you remember Dante's Inferno? Like, they would go to hell. They had a special place in hell. I think they were like seventh circle of hell.
For a tarot card reader as well. There you go. Mm-hmm. So this episode is for all of our fans of tarot and all of our fans of psychics and people who love the carnivals. You know, we're going there. We're going to the sideshow and we're going to the freak show and we're going to Nightmare Alley. The big film that everyone's talking about. Psych.
People are talking about it. They're talking about, wow, this is the fifth big director who's had a flop this year.
Mm-hmm. So, which, you know, whose fault is it? Is it his fault? Is it COVID's fault? Is it streaming's fault?
It's not his fault. I don't think he's to blame on this one.
I don't think it's his fault, but we'll get into that after this cold open. I'm Nicole.
And I'm Rolando.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast
about unoriginality. Rolando, Eddie is not here with us yet, but he will be joining us.
He will be joining us. We just got out of a 4-hour wait to get our COVID tests. And the dog is anxious for a walk, so we had to walk him and hop onto this recording. Yeah. So, yeah.
COVID, so what did you do in a car for 4 hours?
We were, you know what? We were stupid. We should have been watching movies. But like I said, I was watching TikToks and playing games on my phone, and Eddie was reading.
Oh, was he reading The Golem and the Genie?
Yeah, he's trying to finish it up.
Okay. You know what? That's great then.
And he was just very, very much in the book, so I had nothing to do. And I thought, stupid of me, I was going to be in and out, right? I was just like, it's after Christmas. Who wants to get their test taken? But no, of course, everyone wants to get their test taken because everyone wants to hang out on New Year's Eve. Yeah. Myself not included, because I have officially canceled all my New Year's Eve plans because I was exposed twice to COVID, Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, by two separate people. So I am just like, you know what? I think God is trying to tell me if I don't have COVID, stop risking it. So here we are.
There you go. I'm so sorry to hear that.
It's fine. I mean, I wouldn't have bothered taking the test, but Eddie needs to, because in his line of work, he meets with potential people who are high risk. So
yeah,
you know, he's the one who needed Tesla. And I, like I said, I thought it was gonna be in and out, and here we are, end of 2021, and it's like shit hasn't changed. So remember what last week when we talked about, like, how what a depressing Christmas? I think this was like the final, like, strawberry on top of just like, oh, by the way, you might have COVID again.
True. Well, at least you didn't spend it alone. I know some people who spent Christmas alone.
That's so true. I am blessed. You know,
there
I
are
spend
some
alone.
Positives.
But hopefully, the people that I spent it with may have gotten me COVID. So
that's true. Hopefully the positives we find won't be a positive test.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, we're here to talk about nightmares, which is fitting.
I guess so, right?
Because you just came out of a 4-hour nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
So I am really excited for this week. This was one that I really pushed for, and this is kind of one that, you know, is kind of more my, I guess, my taste level, because this is a film, the first one we're talking about is from the 40s, and it's a film noir, and that's just like my jam, right? I eat that for breakfast.
Is that considered a film noir?
It absolutely is. Now, of course, you're thinking, but there's no detectives. There's
no
noticeable femme fatale. But film noir, isn't just detective stories.
I don't think they're just detective stories. I would agree with that. I think there is a hard-boiled character, and I don't think he wasn't hard-boiled enough, in my opinion. He was too suave.
Right, but film noirs are also, you know, the way that they portray society and the point of view that they take is supposed to be cynical and dark. And I would say that Nightmare Alley, the 1947 version, the first one we'll talk about, is one of the darkest, like, films of the 40s. And there's a lot of at least psychological violence that occurs in that film, if not physical, you know? And it's shadowy as fuck. I mean, you know, I'm going to point out some great cinematography when we talk about this. But first, let's talk a little bit about some history. My favorite part.
Sure.
This is based on a novel that came out by William Lindsay Gresham. It's the most famous novel he ever did. And all his subsequent books were never as quite as famous as this, which led to depression and among many other factors, which included his wife leaving him for author C.S. Lewis and perhaps
the guy, the Christian.
Yes.
Wow.
I know, right? Cheese me.
I can't believe that he would take her. Wasn't he like a devout Christian or something? Like, isn't that like a sin to leave your husband?
I know. You know, people who are so devout, you know, doing shit like divorcing, like marrying a divorced person, the nerve of them.
Yeah.
I'm joking.
C.S. Lewis, by the way, if you don't know, he is the writer of the Chronicles of Narnia series.
Yep. Yeah, sorry, I lost my place in my notes. Really great. yes, he is. And he wrote a Greek mythology retelling. And, you know, he's a really famous author. Not nearly, Lindsay Gresham is not nearly as famous as him. So, you know, this book was the most famous thing he ever did. Mm-hmm. Didn't have some subsequent books after. Possibly got diagnosed with cancer. Had alcoholism. Had psychological trauma. He committed suicide. And, you know, so it's oddly, weirdly,
fitting,
ironically fitting that the author of Nightmare Alley did commit suicide at the age of 53. But anyway, he heard a lot of stories. He was obsessed with carnivals and he had some background in it. But, you know, during his time in the war in the 30s, he got a lot of different stories from people about carnivals and sideshows and geek shows. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I didn't know until I saw the original film. A geek show is where you go and you see a person who is just not in very good psychological condition who bites the head off of a chicken. And that is the freak show that you see, is that there's a person who can bite the head off of a chicken.
I know. Right? What a letdown, because I don't know. It's just like biting the head off of a chicken, like Ozzy Osbourne bit the head off of a bat. So it's just like, who is really, is a chicken
this
that
was
much more impressive?
In the 20s and the 30s,
I'm just saying,
Ozzy Osbourne
just like,
was in the
like,
80s.
I guess, yeah, expectations were much lower back then. Also, were you aware that this is where the word geek comes from? Because I didn't, and like geek culture is such a thing now, you know what I mean?
Yeah, interesting, huh? So
like, I'm assuming, so my guess is that it was a pejorative term to, you know, offend people who were like quote-unquote nerds. This is like, oh, you're a fucking geek. That means that you fucking drink chicken blood or whatever. But I guess we have co-opted that and it's now like a positive thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look at that. Taking back things and making them positive. Good for us, right?
Us.
We could
say. You consider yourself a geek?
What would you consider me, a nerd?
A film nerd, yeah.
Oh, so I'm not a geek, I'm a nerd.
I feel like geek now is specific to like comic book and like sci-fi shit. Like I don't know.
Oh, so you guys have reclaimed it again.
Have we? I mean, you thought you were
a geek? For more comic book stuff.
You read also? I feel like readers have to be more nerds.
I guess so. That's the thing. Like back in the day when people like in the 70s, when they were called geek, you know, what were they be like referred to? Someone who's smart or someone who likes comic books?
I don't know. I guess like Milhouse is what I think of as a geek.
Hmm.
Right.
OK, interesting. All right. Yeah. Anyway, we're getting off track. So the point is that this book came out in 1946 and immediately the rights got bought up by MGM. Right. So it's 1947. 1947 is not a very it's a pretty forgettable year in terms of cinema, at least in my opinion.
Uh-huh.
You know, the highest grosser is a film called Welcome Stranger with Bing Crosby, which I'm sure you've never heard of.
No.
It's okay. The Oscar winner for Best Picture that year was Gentleman's Agreement with Gregory Peck, which is a good film, but you know, not one that I'm like everybody needs to see Gentleman's Agreement right now. Like
I've
I'm not saying that.
Even heard of
You've
it.
You've never well, that's not saying much. But I will say I will say that it was a huge year for Christmas movies. I think, you know, like there was a lot of cynical air after World War II. And, you know, the film that won the Oscar the year before, The Best Years of Our Lives, was just such a dark portrayal of, you know, what reality was like after coming home from the war, that I feel like everyone needed a big lift in their spirits. So movies like The Bishop's Wife and Miracle on 34th Street and It Happened on 7th Avenue, they all came out in 1947. So all the big Christmas classic movies came out the year after It's a Wonderful Life. So anyway, Tyrone Power was an actor who was known for being in swashbuckler films and playing romantic leads. And after he went to the war. He had experience in the war. And he was like, I don't want to play these fucking roles anymore. Mm-hmm. I want to, you know, play more kind of tough guy, kind of, you know, not the best hero kind of roles. And so he was the one who pushed for them to buy the rights for Nightmare Alley because he wanted to star in it.
Yeah, and not a hero he was.
Yes.
Not. What? Not a hero. Whatever. You know, we know.
Yeah, we know what you're saying. Yeah. So he lobbied for 20th Century to get the rights. And Daryl F. Zanuck, the head of it, reluctantly agreed to buy the rights. He was not a fan of this property. And the big reason why this film flopped was because Daryl F. Zanuck was like, fine, I'm going to buy it, but I'm not going to promote it. And he didn't fucking promote the film. And that's why it was a flop.
Oh, interesting. That is super interesting because I have this property must be cursed because I also don't think, I guess Disney owns Searchlight Studios, right?
I think so.
I think they own it now after the Fox merger. Because it's
Fox. Yeah.
So they didn't do a real good job promoting the new one either, though.
They did not. Yeah. So, you know, there's something really interesting about this material that is not, let's say it's not inviting, but, you know, nonetheless, it's interesting material. Okay. So screenplay, Jules Furthman and the producer, George Jessel, they're all people who contributed to kind of like the watering down of this heavy ass novel, because it's also, we got to remember 1947, we're very much in the code. Right. Mm-hmm. We are adhering to the production code. And one of the big things that the production code says is that people who commit crimes cannot benefit from those crimes. Right. They always have to be victims to the law. They can't get away with crimes. They can't get away with murder. Any of that shit.
Right.
So you have a really fucking dark novel, which we'll get into soon, being turned into a Hollywood movie with a big star like Tyrone Power. You know, they're going to have to take out some key shit. Right. And before, if you've not seen Nightmare Alley, spoilers ahead, but some of the things that the code had to take out from the novel are things like abortion, infidelity, and murder, right?
The infidelity was there aplenty.
It's interesting. It's how you read it. It was enough that you could read it differently. Let's say that.
Okay. I mean, I guess it may be more explicit in the novel.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Stan, he, especially if, based, I don't know how much of a direct translation the film is to the novel, but let's be real, Stan was a fuckboy, right?
He was a fuckboy.
So I can only imagine all the dalliances he had the moment he became the great Stanton, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I would agree with that. So Daryl F. Zanuck also did not put this film in recirculation. So this film was not shown to the public for a long time after it was made. Tyrone Power tragically died very early in the mid-50s. It was his favorite role up until he died. He went back to the swashbuckler roles. It's not like this role helped him break out of that, which is really sad, and he loved it. And I think that this film almost got reappraised in the 80s. That's how long it took for people to look at this film and be like, oh, hey, this is a pretty interesting film that came out from Hollywood in the 1940s. And I think the reputation, it doesn't really have a reputation. And that's because it wasn't shown for so long. It just kind of disappeared. And then it came out of nowhere and was like, hey, guys, this came out. Remember this?
Film nerds like you to find it and then like say, yeah. Like, watch this. Yeah. Watch this, please.
Eventually but now,
someone relented, you know.
Exactly. But now we have another film that might, you know, also bring in more interest in going back and watching the 1947 one. In 2019, it was announced that Fox Searchlight Pictures would let Guillermo del Toro make a new adaptation of the novel. And he co-wrote it with a woman whom I really love. She's a great film critic and someone whose film knowledge I envy, Kim Morgan, a big fan of hers. And so they co-wrote the script together. And yeah, and I mean, you know, it's Guillermo del Toro.
I remember I'm pretty sure he announced it in 2017, actually, like almost on the heels of Shape of Water.
Yeah, his Oscar winner. Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty much, you know, oh my God, what's going to be his big follow up? And Guillermo del Toro, one of the only filmmakers that a lot of people know by name and look forward to seeing a new film by, I think. You know, Pan's Labyrinth, The Devil's Backbone.
I hated Pacific Rim.
Pacific Rim was not his best. You know, people love Hellboy. I've never seen Hellboy.
We never covered it either because I think it was well in the heels of the. I think we were off because of the pandemic. I want to say I could be mistaken about that, but
yeah, I'm not sure. He made a film with Jessica Chastain and Tom Hiddleston that I didn't see either, and then The Shape of Water, and yeah. I don't remember that film, the name of it. But anyway, this is his highly anticipated new film. I at least thought it was highly anticipated. It's got a great cast, too. It's got Bradley Cooper. Who, you know, is more and more, the more I see him, and I just saw Licorice Pizza, he's winning me over.
Bradley Cooper, he stopped drinking. He stopped drinking, and it shows. He looks great.
Wow, I was going to say, he really knows how to play an alcoholic.
Well, I think from experience, right?
The second film on this podcast with Bradley Cooper playing an alcoholic. Rooney Mara, Toni Collette, all-star cast. And yet, once again, this film has flopped. And it raises questions, you know, why? Is it streaming? Is it the time of year with COVID? Is it the fact that adults, older people, who really are the ones who are going to go see this movie, they're not going to the theater anymore. They're too scared or too lazy or whatever it is, you know? Yeah.
I think it's a little bit of all three, right? Like, I think it's, I think I saw it best summarized on a tweet that I was reading, right? Because I was reading an article about this, so I'll try to link it if I can find it. But the article was basically, you know, this one tweet that they quoted basically said, it's just like, it just shows the kind of difference audience mindsets there are. The kind of audience that watches a Spider-Man movie doesn't care about the pandemic versus the kind of audience that would watch a movie like West Side Story or Ridley Scott movie, this one, right? Like, these are all they're all the audience who are taking the pandemic seriously. However, there is a counter argument to that. It's just like, the Spider-Man movie had such wide appeal that I think people were just hungry for a blockbuster to go see. And there was all those rumblings about, like, oh my God, we're going to see all these Spider-Men together. Here, I don't know, like, I didn't know anything about this movie. You've been pushing this for forever. You've been pushing this for a while, this movie. And I constantly, I'm like, I don't even know what this movie, I thought it was going to be like one of those, like The Blythe Spirit, you remember that movie? Where it was just like an obscure movie out of nowhere. That we covered, and that was not the case. When I found out that it was Guillermo del Toro, I'm like, Guillermo del Toro, this is the first I'm hearing about this, and that was like last month, you know. So it's just bad marketing. At least West Side Story, I'd known for a while was coming out because I don't know, like, the buzz from Steven Spielberg doing a musical was enough to like get me to pay attention, to be critical, right? I don't know. Had I known it was a Guillermo del Toro movie, like, I don't know if I would be, I don't know. So what's your opinion on Guillermo del Toro movies in general? Like, do you get excited when you hear, like, he's going to make a new movie?
Not as excited as I do about other filmmakers. You know, my favorite, I love Edgar Wright. You know, I get excited about his movies. I'll get excited about a Tarantino movie. I'll get excited for a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, I guess. There are other filmmakers who I respect, but I don't get as excited as other people do, like, say, Wes Anderson. And I would say that about Guillermo del Toro. But I'm usually not disappointed by Guillermo del Toro, even if I don't love it. I'm usually like, that at least was a good film. I didn't love it, but it was a good film. So I know that I'm not going to be let down when I see one of his films.
Yeah. I think I feel the same way, where I like Guillermo del Toro's work, but like, I love Pan's Labyrinth. I hate Pacific Rim.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I haven't seen Shape of Water because I don't know if I wanted to see a movie about a fish fucking a woman, you know? Eddie insists it's more than that, but I have my doubts.
Yeah. Well, it's an Oscar winner, so it's definitely more than a fish
that
fucking
means
a woman.
Nothing.
No, nowadays it means nothing.
I think nowadays more than ever it means nothing. I think it's a politics game.
It's always been a politics.
I know, but like that, I think now it's becoming much more evident almost in the last few years.
They need to be less transparent about it.
Yeah. I mean, like, when the Green Book
bought
won,
bullshit back in the day easier than we do, so that's definitely why. And yeah, after Green Book,
at the Green
bullshit.
Book though, I think people were just saying, it's like, okay, like the Oscars, they're not real anymore, like there's no
fuck that anymore. I forgot about that. Thank you for reminding me about that.
Of course, I will never let the Green Book forget its sins.
Seriously. So we're gonna approach this podcast like we did for West Side Story. If you listen to that episode, we're actually going to talk about both versions as once, as we tell you the story of the film and we review the story and we go, you know, from the beginning to the end.
Yep.
Nightmare Alley is the story of Stanton Carlisle in the 1947 version, played by Tyrone Power, and 2021 Bradley Cooper. Stanton in the original works at the carnival, but in the new one we actually see how he comes across this carnival and eventually gets a job there.
He was burning a body and then he was fleeing town, got on a bus, fell asleep on the bus that goes round and round, ends up in a town with a carnival, and he meets Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting because there are two completely different introductions to this character, right? I mean, well, first of all, Tyrone Power uses his looks to play Stanton Carlisle to the max, right?
He does. And let's talk about that real quick. What good looks he had. I thought he was very, very handsome.
Very, very handsome. Really nice voice. Really suave. And Tyrone Power uses this to Stanton Carlisle's, you know, this character's benefit. You know, this Stanton Carlisle knows how hot he is, how suave and charming he is, and he uses it completely to his advantage.
He's very, very magnetic.
Yes, and it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people find Bradley Cooper to be very attractive, but Bradley Cooper doesn't necessarily make himself overt. He doesn't rely on it like Tyrone Power kind of uses it to his advantage. You know, he's got this mustache and he looks a lot more haggard, you know, and he does almost seem like mysterious in a weird way. He's so quiet.
He started off with a mustache?
Yeah, and then he shaves.
Oh, I don't remember.
Yeah, he's got, I think so. Like when he, am I remembering incorrectly that at least
know,
he's getting.
Yeah, because I know that Xena comments on the mustache when, you know, they come to the hotel.
Oh, interesting.
And she
does
one of these things.
Yeah, you know. and then he cleans up. But when we first see him, you know, he's got some facial hair.
Okay, got it.
Perceptive
I am. Yeah.
But you know, the moment we see Tyrone Power's Stanton Carlisle, you know, he's fully working at the carnival for Xena. He's part of Xena and Pete's gang, and he's watching the geek show, and that's how it starts. You know, they take this whole geek show bookend from the beginning in the 1947 one. But, you know, we don't really hear Bradley Cooper speak for a while, but we watch him. We watch him burn the body and the bus, like Rolando said. And then we see him go into this carnival and watch the geek show. And
I don't even think we get his name for a while.
We don't. Yeah. We just kind of are like drifting with him, you know,
like it's Bradley Cooper. That's all I know. Oh, by the way, guys, FYI, sorry. I did see these movies in the correct order. I saw the old one first and then the new one.
Well, good for you. I'm so glad. I hope that worked out to the advantage. Other.
Basically,
look at that. Oh. So the original film also doesn't really show us what a geek show is, but this new film does. And like we said earlier, what a geek show was, you know, thank God for CGI because we know it's not real.
I don't know. I feel like Guillermo del Toro would be. It's just like you commit. He has a Spanish accent. You will commit. No, that's whatever.
That's Italian, I think. Let's not do accents. No. The new film. Bradley Cooper, you know, befriends, like Rolando said, William Dafoe's character, who's kind of like the owner of this carnival.
Mm-hmm.
I think his name is Clem.
Hoatley?
Clem Hoatley, that's right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he stays with Clem. And it's right, you get to see the carnival through his eyes. You know, he's kind of like taking inventory of everybody silently. And that's how we're kind of introduced. Whereas in the 1947 one film, you know, we're picking up midpoint. You know, he's already established.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we meet Xena, played by Toni Collette in the new one, and the original played by Joan Blondell, who's just I think she's really, really gorgeous. And we see that Xena and Pete are in a relationship and they have this whole great act, you know, where she takes your cards, she turns them on fire, and then from her mind she reads them, but really Pete's on the bottom writing them out and showing them to her. Really, right. really clever. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because this film immediately also takes the point of view of, you know, the people who work these shows, and they show you how their quote unquote tricks are done. And you kind of see that it's all kind of a con trick. And it's a confidence right. trick. So this both films immediately also kind of show you that you're being one played, you know, that this is all kind of like a trick and does kind of call bullshit. And if you wanted to think of it like that, it does. Like these films like show you, you know, that they're cynical, right? Immediately it's all cynical. It's not, it's like this is all bullshit. This is all a trick. You know, they all, both films go immediately into like, oh, you could read any person. You could look at a person. Everyone thinks that they're, you know, unique, but everyone just wants to, you know, think they're unique, but they're all the same. It's just so cynical right. immediately.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I have opinions on psychics and stuff. And like this, the both movies go right off and start saying, it's just like, no, these are all parlor tricks. They're all cheap tricks. They're all just. Yeah, you could call it cons, right?
Yeah.
And the way these two characters handle cons is different, right? Because Zima in the original 1947 film, she, you know, she's pretending to be a psychic and stuff, and it's all played off for laughs. Whereas we find out from Molly that she has like an actual code that she used to like really be famous for.
Yeah.
But she hasn't used it. We don't know why. All we know is that she just hasn't used it. She's planning on selling it one day to, you know, create her nest egg for her and Bruno, whom she has had a tumultuous relationship
no,
with.
No, Pete.
Right?
Pete.
I'm sorry. Pete. You're right. Pete.
Yeah, Bruno comes in later.
Yeah. Pete and Xena, they've had a very, very tumultuous relationship. She has admitted to being, you know, not faithful. And mm-hmm, yeah. he's himself gone through some dark period spells where they have been estranged. So with the Xena from 1947, there's a lot of guilt in her performance, right? Of like her relationship with Pete. But you don't get that so much in the 2021 version because I think.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, we don't get as much Xena. In the 2021
which
version.
Is a shame because it's like, where the fuck did you get Toni Collette then for?
Yeah, right? Like, did she just end up on the cutting room floor or something? Like, you know, we see that, you know, she pursues him, mm-hmm. but I don't know if they have this whole long affair, but he built more of a, you get more Pete in the new one than you did in the original, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason they did that is because the new Nightmare Alley is really focusing on daddy issues.
Look right? at you. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously, right? Like yeah. Stan has major daddy issues and in Pete he finds a father-like figure. So, in the 1947 movie, like he's a straight-up fuckboy. He's after one thing and that is the punani. Every fucking woman he beats, he is going to get in her pants. And in this one, he really ends up forming relationships with men on some capacity, like father issues, because he himself has a very raw relationship with his own father that we find
yeah.
out.
Yeah, or he goes out of his way for approval from certain mm-hmm. men, for sure. Yeah, with, you know, building a relationship with Clem, with Pete, and so on forth when the film right. goes down. And so Pete and Xena used to do an act, you know. Did they have a name for it, or?
If they did, I don't remember it.
They just used like this, you know, coded language, you know, and they said that they stopped doing it because it would lead them to do a spook show, right? And that you don't want to do a spook show. And what a spook show is that if you can pretend to have something over your eyes and that you know what a person's holding, eventually people think that you'll be able to talk to the dead.
Yeah.
And that is something that they refer to as a spook show and they say, do not do that.
And we have experience with spook shows on this podcast because we covered Blythe Spirit and that is the setup for both those films.
And to tell the truth, where psychics were on and we talked about, you know, not giving platforms to psychics, Rolando is heavily against that. You know, it's interesting though, when Dean Martin's son disappeared he was a pilot and he was flying his plane and it just disappeared. They were so desperate that they consulted a psychic and the psychic told them that he was dead and that they were to find him. And an hour later, they found him in that exact same spot. So sometimes It's not bullshit.
No, it's coincidences.
Or coincidences. Mm. Or maybe
it's,
not.
It's usually just coincidences.
So of course, Stan, as we come to realize, you know, in the 1947 one, yeah, this, his fuckboy persona really does, like, you could tell right away that he's kind of out for the moolah and for the puni. Like, that's it. But, you know, it's kind of like this slow build in the new one. You know, he doesn't wear everything on his sleeves as much as I think the 1947 one does, even though I love Tyrone Power in the movie. But, like, you know, he's just like, he's causing all this attention to come right towards him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. Bradley Cooper doesn't play it like a fuckboy, though. He
doesn't, no.
I think they, you know, they set up a relationship between him and Molly.
Yes.
They actually develop it a little. We get to see it. I think he is a philanderer, sure, but that comes with fame, I feel like.
Yeah, Molly is a local girl who's in a bizarre relationship with an older man named Bruno. I think he's his guardian, her guardian, but he's clearly in love with her.
Well, in the 1947 one, I'm pretty sure, I thought they were a couple.
They were a couple, yeah, but I think they're a couple in both films.
No, I don't think, I think it's more like
he comes like her guardian, uh-huh, because her
he
father,
is her guardian.
Because it seems that he was friends with her father. And he promised the father that if he passes, that he would take care.
I see. Her. Okay.
Yeah, almost like an uncle kind of figure.
Yeah.
Interesting.
In the first
one,
in the 1947 one, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was a sense of that they could have been like in a relationship, but I guess he, like, you know, there is that scene when they're like, all right, you guys are going to get married now. It wasn't like he was like, oh, you betrayed me. You broke my heart. You destroyed our relationship. It was more like, yeah, like, I got the sense of that they seem like a couple, but then that scene was like, okay, maybe they're not a couple. They were just probably
exactly.
Like,
it was like, oh, you're going to fuck her? Then you're going to marry her.
Yeah.
Take care of her, you know? So
yeah, it could be one of those things lost in translation when you're adapting a book that apparently was a lot seedier than the actual movie's allowed to be. Right.
Yeah,
so maybe they had to like kind of obscure that a little, because let's be real, Molly in both these movies is the moral compass in both mm-hmm. these films. And mm-hmm. as the moral compass, she can't really, you know, it kind of we would look down on her if she did, in fact, cheat on her husband to go off with Stan. Right. Because then what kind of morality does she have? But
exactly,
I'm sure in a novel.
Yeah.
You have the privilege of being a lot more gray instead of black and white.
Yeah. So in both films, you know, he's kind of like he's sleeping with Zena on the side, but he's got, you know, he's got eyes and a torch for Molly, but he's got eyes for this code, right? He wants to fucking learn it, and he wants to get out of here and have his own act with it.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell it's very much his goal. And a couple things happen. One, a sheriff comes and tries to tear the place down. In both versions, he gets to show off his con man tricks where he reads people. He does a cold reading, as they say, where he just kind of takes details from the man's outfit and puts together like this whole thing where it's like, oh, I see a woman or I see a man or something. Like, he reads him pretty much. Mm-hmm. And the sheriff falls for it. But you already immediately, you know, see how much that trick toys with people's emotions, right? So you don't see it to the max of how far it can go, but you could see exactly the amount of power that, you know, Stanton feels when he can do this, you know, and how far he could take it.
Yeah.
And to me, it's immediately fucked up.
I mean, yeah, but I've always wished that I could, like, cold read, you know? Like, I wish that was a skill. I mean, I don't know if it's a skill that you can learn or you're just, like, naturally born with it.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, so it's interesting because it reminds me of like those famous detectives who look at people and like know things about them. But it's more so like just build. I would do that more so as building up evidence against people.
Well, yeah, I mean, but Sherlock Holmes was like a mentalist in that sense, right?
Yes,
like
he was
very observant.
And so is Poirot. Yeah.
Psych is another one that comes to mind, where he was trained to be, you know, the reason he's called Psych is because he pretends to be psychic, but he doesn't have the power. He just knows how to do good cold reads to get information, right?
And he psychs you.
Yeah.
Hey.
That's it.
Psych, I fooled you.
So in both versions that occurs where, you know, Stan reads the sheriff and the sheriff does not close the place down, everyone's like, yay for Stan. And then also, what was the other big thing that happens?
He fucks Molly finally.
Oh yeah, Pete. That's the other big thing. Oh, that happens, Pete.
That happens before the sheriff comes to town, though.
In which film?
In the 1947 one, it happens before.
Yeah, I mean, Pete, these are, so, yeah, they're kind of, yeah, and we're not going to go in complete order.
The big important thing is Pete dies, and in both versions, Stan is one way or another involved in his death. It's not outright murder. It's more like manslaughter. Although I feel like one film paints it a lot more accidental than the other. Do you agree?
Yes. Yes. Well, we're talking about the 1947 one because they had to. Remember, he cannot get away with any sort of crime. So he had to, not complacent at all for it. So in the original film, immediately we're seeing that it's a complete accident that Pete dies at the hands of a swamping of an alcohol bottle that, you know, poor Stanton Carlisle didn't even know about, you know, but he has to also cover his tracks because he can't let anyone know because they'll be mad at him and he won't be able to explain that it's an accident.
Zima won't put out anymore.
And Zima won't put out and they won't have their trick. You know, come on, he needs the code. Mm-hmm. In the new film, it's a lot more ambiguous. Pete dies. We don't really hear about it. And it slowly gets brought up when we meet a new character later on. So what do you think? Do you think that ambiguousness as to, you know, not really stating his involvement? What do you think?
I mean, I think the ambiguity works in the 2020, in the new one, only because I think they did a good job of, like, us, the audience, we know we were paying attention. Like, it's just like red is wood, blue is anyone can drink it. But we know also that, like, Stan wasn't necessarily paying attention because he didn't care, because he himself does not drink. He actually makes it a point of honor that he does not drink.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that, like, when he went to buy the booze for Pete, he wasn't paying attention. He's just like, all right, here you go.
Yeah. And something was happening with the geeks, or there was a geek. We actually get to know these geeks in the new film, too.
I mean, that's what he get very, very.
The making of.
Yeah, yeah, we get to understand how they get made. Yeah.
And
we also, that's where we found out what the fuck Nightmare Alley means, because I had no idea. Did you know what a Nightmare Alley is?
Yeah, exactly. Why don't you say it, Rolando?
Oh, from context clues in the new one, a Nightmare Alley is just where those alleys where, like, opioid users or alcoholics just, like, they riffraff just, like, live, you know? Which I guess was a thing that was happening a lot in the 1940s. I don't know. Not from that time period.
Yeah.
But what a cool term, Nightmare Alleys. I don't think we get a lot of Nightmare Alleys anymore in these parts. Maybe after COVID. Who knows?
Maybe. Who knows? But in the new one, they actually do explain, you know, there's a lot more sympathy shed on geeks. You know, they're kind of like this taboo thing that we don't really want to talk or show about in the old film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, almost like the unseen, it makes it even more like, what is this?
Right.
But in the new film, we see it. We get to humanize and really, really show how they're victims of themselves and of society. And we get to learn what makes a geek, right? So you need someone who's really down on their luck, someone who's desperate, you know, at least a 2-bottle-a-day alcoholic. They need to come to you and you need to promise them, oh, it's only until we get another geek. This is the job that I can put you in. It won't be for too long. And then you have to put opioids in their drink so that they unknowingly become addicted to heroin. So it's so fucked up that you pretty much have to destroy a person.
Yeah, and then you also have to, like, sober them up. There's that point, that crossroad of like, is it going to be a permanent thing? And you do this whole, like, sober them up. You don't give them a drink, and then they just go through the shakes and the torture and the nightmares and alcohol withdrawal.
All for them to have their successful sideshow.
And unknowingly, opium withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Too. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, yeah, I'll do whatever you want. Just give me a drink. And then you have them. Then you create it.
Too. Yeah.
So that, I mean, that explanation over steak and eggs, and a smile on his face.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe. What a creepy performance.
And
yeah, he's great. I love that actor.
And you can see Bradley Cooper's character just kind of be totally disgusted by it.
Yeah, like, actually feel sorry. Because, you know, the thing about Stanton Carlisle is he's a total narcissist. He doesn't care about anybody but himself. But in that moment, you actually see him pity someone else. You know, he genuinely feels bad. And there is this weird, like, he almost feels connected to geeks. You know, somebody being so victimized in that way and just taken, you know, for granted and treated that way.
Well, and there's also, and this will play later, but it's not just about feeling victimized. It's also about this. Willem Dafoe's character says it a great line where he talks about the reason that people want to see a geek show is because they feel better about themselves and their and where they are. And ultimately, the 2021 film, he is constantly looking for that. He's constantly looking for that validation that he is better than everyone. That's why he loves cold reading, right? Because he feels better than the person who he's reading.
This is just a power in that
being
superior over everyone. But he also describes that in the sense of being a performer too, because you have the secret, you have the code, or you have the little tricks, and you're able to create this wonder and awe. And these people holding on to every word that you have to say, hoping that you have some truth, you know, something that they want, and that they like see that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would say that both Stanton Carlisle's, they play it slightly differently, but they both play, you know, that to a degree where they just completely, it's like an ego thing for them, and it's like them, you know, self-affirming their own worth every time that they do it, which is why they get more and more carried away with it. So, yeah, so Pete dies. Stanton's getting way better at the confidence tricks, and he courts Molly hard enough that she's like, okay, so you're going to marry me, right? And it's interesting because in the 1947 one, he's forced into it, right?
Yeah.
Her guardian, Bruno, and Xena, who's like, oh, you're fucking two-timing me, are like, all right, fine. You're taking this girl, then you're going to marry her. Have some responsibility. It's also the 40s. They can't be together unless they get married. And it's interesting because in the 1947 film, he's kind of not happy about it until he realizes how he can use it to his advantage.
Right, right. It's true. Once a fuckboy, always a fuckboy.
Yeah, which is interesting because to me, that's a lot more darker than the 2021 film. In 2021 film, they actually are in love. And, you know, he wants to give her the world and he wants to take her away from that place and you know, bring her away. So it's just so interesting how the 1947 one film plays that way darker and way more cynical than the more recent film would.
I think it's unintentional the way that happened, but it could be sensibilities.
It could be, yeah. But so now Molly and Stan, a couple years later down the road, they've got Xena and Pete's old trick. And he uses it and he brands himself the Great Stanton. And what he does is that he puts a blindfold over his eye, and she uses the coded language, which I'll never be able to fucking figure out from any version of this. Can you tell me what I have in my hand? And by the way, she forms the question, he's able to say, you know, oh, you have a watch in your hand or whatever.
Right.
So, and they both got it down pat, and they're selling out places.
According to the in the 1947 one, they do have it down to a pat. They're kind of relegated to doing hotel shows, and he wants even more grandiose. He wants even more power behind his name. In the 2021 version, he's constantly belittling Molly. It's just like, you did it wrong. You didn't do this right. Ah.
Well, only he knew that, though.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because in the Stand in the 47, he, at that point, I could really feel this was somewhat a semi-abusive relationship here. You know, like, he would always put her down, stuff like that. You got to see in this version, the new version, the sense of that those were the moments that he was upset at her, but pretty much he was kind and tender with her. But when it came to the work itself, it was when he was the hardest. But I really felt like he was. Yeah, there was more of a loving relationship that was more evident in the
new one, one.
Yeah, because it did feel at times like a partnership, but you know, it was the 1940, so like, you know, the man still may call all the shots kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And Molly is just, you know, like you said, she's moral compass and she's very young and she's pretty innocent. And, you know, in terms of the two performances, 2021 being Rooney Mara and 1947's was played by Colleen Gray. Did you have one that you preferred?
I actually preferred the 1947 one because for some reason I know Eddie disagrees with me because like we got in a fight in the car over this, but I thought Rooney Mara was kind of annoying.
Annoying? Okay.
I found her so annoying in this movie. I don't know if it was like if she was so mousy that it just annoyed me. You know, she starts growing a backbone towards the end of the movie, but she was so, I just found her so, every time she spoke, I was just like, God, why is Stan with you still? Why?
Oh my God, I don't understand this.
I don't understand either. It just came, it just like, it just, it was just a feeling I had. Where I found the other one, she was more charming, I guess.
I really loved Colleen Gray.
She was like, kind of like, she was like sweeter. She was kind of like a lot more Pollyannish.
Yeah, I just, there was something about Colleen Gray's performance that just overall works for me more. Yeah, like I bought her overall as Molly. And it was also, it was just really hard for me to see Rooney Mara and Cate Blanchett in the same scene and for them to not be making out. Because Carol is just one of my absolute favorite films. And I think they had such great chemistry in that film. Okay.
Wait,
so I'm just like,
I didn't know that they were.
You guys are lovers. What are you doing?
Okay.
Have you ever seen Carol?
I have not.
Oh, you should see it. It's so great.
I plan to one day. That's Ooh, what's the director's name? I know him. He did.
It's Todd Haynes, who did Todd Safe Haynes, yeah. and Far From Safe. Heaven. That's yeah. It. So yeah, it's his first lesbian film. Exciting. Yeah. So anyway, so it's during one of these hotel shows that they're performing to, you know, a great big audience that Dr. Lilith, what's her last name?
Ritter.
Ritter, thank you. Ritter. Dr. Lilith Ritter appears in the 2021 one, played by Cate Blanchett, and the 1947 one, played by Helen Walker.
Mm-hmm.
Helen fucking Walker.
Wait, am I supposed to know who Helen Walker is?
No, but I want you to remember that name because I think she gave one hell of a fucking performance in the 1947 one film.
I want to say in the 1947 one, like, these women were dynamite. Like,
oh yeah,
all three
all
of them.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say this, especially this at this point of the podcast, but like all three of these, the three women in the original 1947 one walk circles around the three women in the 2021. I'm not saying that their performances were bad in the 2021 version. I'm just saying the original ones just circles.
I just want to bask in this moment that like Rolando is praising these performances from the 40s film over the new one. I'm just loving it.
Because they were good. They were just really, really good. And I think they were very well thought out characters.
Oh, it's interesting though, but because when you say that, it makes me think that you're also giving a critique on the new film, that they're not well thought out characters in the new one.
But I feel like their performances made sense to that particular story, you know? Molly being kind of like, you know, so sweet and so innocent and bubbly, you know, made sense to the Stan character and being a polar opposite. But then the Molly from the new one, there is innocence in the sense of that she hasn't had all the experiences, but there is a desire to see the world. Yes. There's also this, you see her reading a lot. So the sense of like to educate herself, to be knowledgeable. And she does have this sense of right and wrong, and knowing and recognizing she can withstand, you know, she knows that she's strong enough to withstand certain pain, but she knows her limits too.
Yeah.
And I just found, her performance, you know, being, it made more sense to the new story that was this new version that's being told.
I agree with you on that. I think ultimately, this is something I can't talk about without spoiling the ending yet. So just remind me, I wrote it down on my notes here and I will come back to it as to like, why did I think the characterizations of the original women work better for the film than the characterizations of the 2021.
Okay, that's excellent. I will remind you, and you wrote it down too. So when he's putting on a show, Dr. Lilith Ritter tries to call him out, and you know, he reacts to it, takes off his blindfold, and at least does a successful confidence trick on her so he can't be outdone by her. Immediately sees that this woman is kind of, you know, I see something similar in myself in her, you know, and goes to her.
Because in both versions, Lilith, she's always with wealthy men. Mm-hmm. And in both versions, she is skeptical. And she actually, in both versions, she knows exactly what the parlor trick is.
Yes.
But and when she tries to get him to call out, like, it backfires because he is he gets one step ahead of her, and then he does a cold read on her in order to you know, in 2021, embarrass Lilith publicly.
Yes. And so pretty much this makes him go to her and finds out that she's a psychiatrist who likes to tape her recordings and has all the hot tea on Manhattan socialites. Is it Manhattan or is this Chicago?
Chicago.
I think it's Chicago, yeah. On the Chicago socialites and elite.
Yeah.
He finds a kindred spirit in her, you know? It's like, oh, she's also a piece of shit like me, you know? Like, she likes to take people's confidence in the palm of her hand and is like to use it against them.
Yeah, which is interesting. So I don't know why in the 1947 one, it makes no sense how he got to that conclusion, because she was a psychologist. And it's a respected profession.
Yeah, in that one, it just kind of implies that he knew it and he spied on her.
Yeah, I mean,
that's it.
He called her out on recording the sessions, but isn't that like a common practice in psychology?
Recording?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's common, but
I don't know. I mean, when I interviewed that psychiatrist from for my documentary, like, she spoke about like the recording sessions, anything to do it to take notes afterwards. It's uncommon.
Yeah, I think as long as people have, you know, some knowledge that they're being recorded, of course,
yeah,
you can.
I'm pretty
but
sure
I think the implication
consent.
Is that she doesn't ask everyone for their
because it was hidden.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, in the other version, the newer version, you have the mics right there by the desk, so where you're sitting at, you can see the mics.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it seems to record. If you have to record, the recorder needs to be visible.
I got it. So in the 1940s, yeah, I was just confused on the 1947 one. It's just like, this is a big accusation to make of her. She is clearly a doctor. I don't see anything wrong in what she's doing.
I think in the 1947 one, it's even more evident that she's not telling people that she's recording them. It's more
right. I would agree. Yeah. Because she gets all like flustered. But even then, I still didn't have any problem with that, because I just assumed she's like, yeah, but she's a psychologist. She's taking back notes.
Yeah.
You know, seeing like if like he commits a murder, if a patient commits a murder, she can go back to her notes and be like, I must have missed this.
Yeah.
You know?
So, okay. So moving on. Obviously, he gets to be so good as the Great Stanton and gets to get so good at this trick that he kind of borders on doing a spook show. And all it takes is that one client who's willing to pay you a lot of fucking money for you to do that spook show. And in both versions, right, while he's either about to or is in the middle of embarking on, you know, doing a spook show, he gets visited. He and Molly get visited by Bruno and Zena.
Mm-hmm.
And in both versions, he meets them kind of like coldly and being like, you know, wants to act like he's above them and, you know, they're not as welcome as they should be. And Zena reads the tarot cards and pretty much tells him, if you do this spook show, it's going to be your downfall. Now, it's interesting because the 1947 one uses tarot cards a lot more, and it does it so wrong.
Wait, does it?
I don't know. I just, the way that she reads tarot cards in those movies, I feel like, isn't the best representation of tarot cards.
Well, I don't think they have a representation because, like, they're not real. But
if you're going to get your cards read, it's just not going to... Don't look at the 1947 one and be like, oh, that's how my cards are going to be read. It's not going to be like
that. I thought the 1947... The way they used the cards was so effective in the 1947 version, because it was a motif that carried on, and by the end was so evident. It was kind of lovely. It was almost poetic.
I don't care that it's not. I'm not critiquing that they're using tarot cards. I'm just saying they're not using it very like accurately. Is all.
Yeah, it doesn't. I don't think accuracy matters when it's for the it's story. It's
art. Yeah, I'm just saying. Yeah. I'm just poking fun like that. Okay. Like, I don't care, but it's so inaccurate.
Yeah. I guess that's true. I mean, I don't know how tarot cards work. It looked to me like that's how they work. But when she had a freak out in the original one, right, about like the card being on the ground and it's death and Pete being hangman. You know, the hangman card is much more important in the 1947 one because in the 1947 one, they hint that what Pete's fate is what awaits Stan, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, by the end, we'll see whether or not that comes to fruition. However, in the 2021 version, it's less so. It's a little, like, it's more like his actions, I don't know. The fate of the what's it called of the tarot cards isn't as important. It's just like
it isn't. I wonder why, but they use the same exact hangman card, you know, which is interesting because if you get the Criterion Collection edition of Nightmare Alley, they use the hangman card as the cover, which is really really beautiful artwork. So he gets warned, he gets told, don't do the fucking spook show, dude. We told you we didn't want to give you the code because we don't want people doing the spook show. Now you're doing it. Stop, right? Of course, he doesn't listen.
Which actually, I know in the new version, he was warned by Peter. You have to stop using the book the moment you start believing your own bullshit, right? And that's a big takeaway there. You have to stop believing your own bullshit. Don't fall for it. However, in the 1947 one, they were just against the spook show because it was almost blasphemous.
Yeah, so we're almost to the part where the 1947 one has to bring in the moral slant to it for it to get past the code. And because it's the 40s, right? Eventually, in both films, a couple different things happen and a couple different characters come in. But the big character that we meet in both is Ezra Grindel. In the first film, he's an associate of another client of the great Stanton's who's doing the spook show, that he's doing the spook show on that woman, the elderly woman. And he wins Ezra over. But in the 2021 film, it's a man who, you know, is saying, I want you to meet my friend Ezra Grindel, who just so happens to be like a fucking Howard Hughes tycoon. And he's a very, very powerful man that he's trying to do one over on.
A mobster.
Well, I mean, anyone who's that powerful has to be doing organized crime in some way.
It's true. You don't become a billionaire without having a few skeletons in your closet, you know?
Yeah. And the point about Ezra Grindel is because, well, one, this is the second, he was originally just going to do one spook show. Now he's doing more, right? He's getting all these people and they're giving him money and he's getting a lot, which he's splitting with Dr. Lilith Ritter because she's giving him the scoop on these people's, mm-hmm. you know, confessions essentially to her on her bed. And Ezra, he finds out, had a long lost lover named Dory who died. In the original, we don't really know why she tragically died young and right. that he's very, very sorry. And he, you know, he yearns for her and he has something that weighs heavily on him. But what we're not told in the 1947 one, we're told in the new one, which is where she had a back alley abortion and died.
Mm.
And in both versions, Stanton realizes how similar Dory looks to Molly. And for him to, you know, pull over this great con and for him to get the money that he needs. In the original, it's to build a sacred building. What do they call it? Keep calling it? Not a temple.
Tabernacle.
A tabernacle. Thank you. Thank you.
Good job, Eddie.
But in this, the new one, he just wants to be fucking rich. You know, he just wants the money. So it's interesting because the original film kind of goes in more of a religious sand where he starts becoming more of like this saint.
A preacher,
right?
Mm-hmm. A miracle and worker.
When he's like, Molly, I need you to, you know, pretend to be a ghost to fool over Ezra Grindel. She's like, okay, yeah, you're stepping on God's, you know, like toes here. Turf, and you need to stop. And she has this whole thing and they bring in this whole moral slant about, you know, what you're doing is going against God. You're trying to play him and that's fucking wrong. Mm-hmm. And of course you realize, you know, it's the 40s and they have to say all this stuff. But at the same time, she's not wrong. Especially if you believe in that. She's totally right.
And then he makes the same argument that I hear a lot of like modern day psychics and mentalist use, which is just like, yeah, but if I'm bringing comfort, isn't it okay? And it's just like, no, it's not. It's false hope. You're fucking, you are a leech and you're just exploiting these people's sorrows to get ahead. It's fucked up.
And in both
versions, he's making that same argument. It's just like, yeah, but if I'm offering a little bit of solace, right, isn't it okay? It's just like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Stan.
But in the new one, he's saying even more like, oh, this is the last time. This is the last time. Trust me. If you just do this one thing, we'll stop. Oh, yeah, he was like a junkie. Yeah. Yeah, he's making fucking false promises up the wazoo. Yeah.
Which I forgot. The other big thing. So I just realized. So in the 1947 one, the reason he never fucks Dr. Lilith Ritter is because of the code. He's married.
Yes.
And despite the fact that like she was jumping on his bone, basically. In this one,
she tries to seduce him. Yeah.
In the new one, they are very, very much, they get intimate.
Yeah.
The biblical sense with each other.
Yeah. Well, she, yeah. And it's interesting the way Cate Blanchett portrays her, because it seems like she really wants to get to know him and like do a deep dive on him. But, you know, she's also trying to exploit him, but that she might be like super attracted and into him. Like she plays it really interestingly. Whereas
I have
a question
for you. Go ahead.
But in the original, I guess I just felt like she was way more diabolical and cold-hearted. That's all I wanted to say.
In the original?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. We'll talk about that. Cate Blanchett, has her face always been this frozen, or did she like get prosthetics or something to like not move her face? She looked like Nicole Kidman on the red carpet.
No, she's definitely done work to her face, but I feel like her work is not nearly as bad as Nicole Kidman's.
No. But like she was like her face like barely moved. And like I know there was a line that's like that frozen faced bitch. And every time we see her, it's literally snowing.
Like, yeah, that's true. They do use snow and weather a lot more here.
Eddie's the one who noticed it. I was like, every time he sees her, it's snowing. I'm just like, oh, my God, it is. You're right.
Yeah. You know, so I just want to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about cinematography, too, because, you know, you asked the question, is the 1947 Nightmare Alley a film noir? And I say absolutely. I want to bring to your attention something. One, yes, there's a lot of shadow and there's a lot of darkness and there's a lot of fog going on, you know, key things of that. But did you notice that every time we were in Dr. Lilith's office, that the way that the light was supposedly off the walls, it projected bars. And so you felt like you were in a prison. Did you notice that at all?
I can't say I noticed that, but like I've already said in this podcast, I'm not very perceptive. So,
Watching a film noir, you should always pay attention to the angle of a shot, mm-hmm, you know, to the light, and lighting is a huge thing. And the way that it's, if it's either really highly lit or if it's not very highly lit, if there's a lot of shadows and what's being projected from those shadows onto the wall. Mm-hmm. That's a big thing whenever you watch film noir. And that's when you know whether or not you're watching a film noir is the way that it's lit and shot.
Right.
And so, you know, there's the one thing with Xena I noticed was that there was a lot of like bright lights. Like whenever they were talking, there was like almost like their faces were overexposed because of how much light was pouring in from like outside when they were in the tents on them. Mm-hmm. And the things that I noticed in Dr. Lilith's office were that there were always bars on the wall. And it's just, you know, I encourage you to even go to Google Images and look at it. Beautifully shot, right? It's black and white. So, you know, we're given those things to play with in terms of the images that we're given. In this film, you know, we have color and we have CGI. And I think what Guillermo del Toro uses to his advantage is weather. And he just really used snow a lot to really show the coldness of everything, literally. You know, like literally it's getting colder and colder, kind of just like Stan. So
one of the things, too, I did notice though about her office
in the new one,
And
you did notice it. You know who pointed it out to me
is like they
her panels.
That the walls look like Rorschach tests.
Yes, that's what I was gonna say. I saw faces there, and I was like, "Is this intentional?"
It was. I thought it was beautiful set design. I was just "This is an office that I would love to have one day." Can we just talk about? Can we just appreciate Art Deco? What a fucking look.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. I
was telling Eddie on our way back home, but she's like, "This is a fucking look that should come back." Like it's so gaudy, it's so excessive, but it's so fucking beautiful. Because I mean, there was a room when he's talking to Ezra, it's just a room, it's just like a gigantic hall just with two chairs in it, right? Like this is the only use for this room, and it's just like, god, how lavish, how chic. I want that. You know.
Yeah. And I will say the one thing I'll give 2021 version is when you bring up that scene and, you know, they put the lie detector on him, is that you really get a sense of the tightrope that he's walking in this film. Because in the 1947 one, he's playing them for fools. And, you know, it just takes one thing to go horribly wrong for him to get caught out. But he's playing them really well. You really see that he's playing with fucking fire in the new one.
Yeah.
And I think they built up that suspense very well.
They did a good job of creating stakes in the 2021 version.
Yes.
That wasn't necessarily present in the 1947 one. Where the 1947 one felt like little vignettes that just lead to the next. This one had like, there would be consequences. And we actually got to see those consequences. So what happened to Dr. Lilith in the 2021, right? We got to see her, I don't know, she was like cut in half or something for some reason and still alive. That seems like a very dicey surgery to have in the 1940s.
Well, they also made it, you know, like they gave an explanation for why she was a cold-hearted bitch, whereas in the 1947 one, she's just a cold-hearted bitch. And because, I don't know, there's just something about Helen Walker's portrayal of that character that is just so cold and fantastic.
I know, but at the same time, too, it doesn't... I guess what I felt was is walking away from the first original being like, what was her motive, really? Like, what was this all about?
Cause you don't think it was money's not enough?
No, I think there was more to it. I just feel like she was already established in a profession where women, as always, you know, at that time period, where women weren't considered to be the best option in these professions.
Yeah,
right? In other words, that you know that she had to work hard. You know that she had to overcome certain things to establish herself and to build a reputation, right? Yeah. Why would she put all that on the line just for money? And at the same time, too, in both movies, money is given to her. Like, here, this is your half. And then it's like, you know what? And then she's like, no, it's not about the money. And it's like, and then Stan, I don't know, he's an idiot. I don't know. It's like, take all the money. Why don't you hold on to all the money? You know? And it's like her, money was an incentive, definitely. But I felt like for the original, I was like, well, there had to be more than just this. Because there was just a level of cruelty that, it's just not in a vacuum.
So, all right.
Hold that thought. In a vacuum.
I think both of you should hold that thought because I think that's all going to lead up to our endings and then we can get into that discussion, which is ultimately about like what was Lilith's angle in both these movies? Because I think Eddie makes a fair point and I have issue, though, with the 2021 version.
Okay. Eventually, he takes a lot of convincing to get Molly to participate in being Dory's ghost to fool Ezra Grindel. And both scenes, you know, it's interesting. I actually think I like the 1947 one just because she's further away. She's like appears. It's the music. It's the fog. And he gets him to get on his knees and it lasts longer. She's out there kind of walking around and you have enough time with it all to be like, oh, this is fucked up.
Yeah, because we get a close-up of her really face and she's, like, watching him. Like,
yeah, well, not immediately. Not immediately. She's a distant thing. You can't really see her, right? It's handled pretty differently in the 2021 where she's immediately there. Yeah, and she's got blood and it just doesn't look real at all, at least to me, right?
Well,
the addition of blood. Like, she actually seems like a ghost lurking in the background in the 1947 one. And it's interesting too because I was listening to this critic talk about the film, you know, in the 40s, that's when we started getting ghost movies. I don't know if you know this, you know, comedies, Blight Spirit being one of them, Ghost of Mrs. Muir. We got our first haunted house film with Ray Milland in like 1945. Mm. You know, ghosts started really appearing, you know, right after World War II, this like longing, I think, for people to connect with people that they lost.
Right.
You know, so this is a big thing going on post-World War II. And I thought that the way that they handled it in the 1947 one, and it just, the sequence lasts longer. She's more distant and she actually does seem kind of like this ghost, you know, out there in the fog. It makes it even more tragic to me.
Well, yeah. It's intentional, I think, right? To play it up. I think it was supposed to feel silly because on some level, it is a silly plan.
When you see Tyrone Power's face and you see, like, it in his face where he's like, fucking idiot. Like, he makes a face where he looks at Ezra, and Ezra is like, he's apologizing, you know, and he's so sad. And of course he drops to his knees. So it makes it also more tragic. Whereas the new one, I think it happened kind of fast. To me, it wasn't as like I didn't believe it. Of course, Ezra did. And that's what's important. But like, you know, they kind of play it up a little bit, not as ghosty and just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
The blood on the hand and everything was weird.
And then you have his confession, though. You have his confession.
Right, which I think was more important in this one than the
because
ghost part.
In the first one, I'm feeling sorry.
Yeah.
For the rich guy. But in the second one, you know, when he confessed, it's like how cruel he's been. It's like, yeah.
This guy sucks.
Yeah, daddy issues kicks right in.
Yep. And of course, Ezra, what were you going to say?
Wait, I just want to point out for everyone to know this. This is where Eddie said the most romantic thing to me, I think, in our entire relationship. Eddie, can you repeat what you said after we saw the ghost scene gone wrong?
What did I say?
Oh, you don't remember? Okay. he said, he's just like, if we were ever in that situation, I would still be able to go through with it for you. Yes.
That I would keep the charade for you.
And I was just like, oh my God, how sweet. And I pulled out my notebook. I was just like, here are all the cons we're gonna start doing.
But of course, in both versions, Ezra can't help himself. He thinks, you know, this is what's the word? That she's
real.
Yeah, like her body has materialized. So he tries to go to her, and more so in the 1947 one, she just like, she feels how fucked up what they're doing is, and she totally freaks out about it. She does in the new one too, but you know, like, she makes more of a scene of it in the 1947 one. And Ezra's like, what the fuck is this? And feels hurt and betrayed. Both versions, you know, he has to get violent with him, but in the 1947 one, it's like he pushes him and then Ezra hurts his head because, you know, again, he can't commit crimes like that.
Right.
So, you know, it's like, oh shit, I think I might have hurt him. Let me get out of here. And the new one, he kills him. Straight up fucking beats the shit out of him. He died. Are you kidding me? He remember when he's cleaning up his hand and he found glass in his knuckle?
Oh, I thought that was glass from when he was breaking the windows. Did you not see his face?
And you know, this is Guillermo del Toro's trademark. He has this thing about collapsing people's faces and heads. Just showing that. Just like
yeah.
I mean, Guillermo del Toro makes gore. Because when
he runs over the guy twice, you know, his head,
Yeah,
the movie did get really gory really fast.
So it's interesting because in the 1947 one film, him trying to become, you know, a preacher, trying to open up a tabernacle, and almost getting off on psychologically abusing people is how the 1947 one gets dark and violent. But in this one, we get physically violent, you know. He tries to port the thing over and it doesn't work, so he resorts to murder. And, you know, that's just as bad as psychological. I mean, well, what do you think is more effective? The psychological violence or the physical violence?
I just want to point out, but it wasn't, again, it was like an act of passion. This wasn't like murder for the sake of murder. He wasn't murdering her. Right?
What am I going to do?
But he was, again, this is where his daddy is. No. It was about his, you're talking about like the guard. Yeah. But the daddy issues that ignites everything, though, that's because we're seeing this trauma, this relationship that he had with his father, again, transferred into this guy. When this guy admitted to the abuses, he was just like, fuck this guy. And it's an older man. And all of a sudden, like, all his daddy issues just comes into play and he beats the shit out of him. So it made sense. And it was a little more tragic, I guess, than just like having the guy knock and fall on his head. Maybe, you know, I'm a child of the 80s and 90s where violence is A-OK with me. You know,
it's more effective for you in the story.
I think because it raises the stakes for what is for the mess that he's in now, right? Like, now he's committed a murder. When the other one, he's just running because he may have hurt an old guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, so it's interesting because you beautifully pointed out that the new film really runs with the daddy issues thing and with the anger he has. But I really think that they took for the 1947 film psychological abuse, right? I think that that's what they're going with. Even Tyrone Power talks about it. His stand talks about it right after he fools the sheriff. And he said, no, and they're like, hey, where'd you learn how to talk to people like that? Where'd you learn that gospel? And he's like, oh, in Sunday school after they gave us a sermon after beating me all week. You know, and he talks about the psychological abuse that he took, you know, and
Catholics
know about
psychological abuse.
And he knows the best way to, you know, fuck with people is to kind of like beat them down psychologically, which is what happens to him in the 1947 one, right? Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because I think that with the daddy issues, the only way it had to result was within violence. And that was the fitted way for their story and their portrayal of Stanton Carlisle. But I really love the way that they kind of put everything and almost ended it, you know, with the cherry on top in the 1947 one, with the whole psychological abuse angle that they were going for in the 1947 one. Mm-hmm. Because when all of this happens, he goes to Dr. Lilith. He's like, I got to get out of here. Give me the money that I entrusted you with. And she plays him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't realize this in the 1947 one until he's in a cab and he has to come back. But he realizes it at the moment after. Oddly enough, in the 2021 one, after she's like, I really do love you, Stan. And then he's like, Wait a minute.
Yeah, because open the back. He knew. And I actually, so funny. I actually initially had trouble with that. I was just like, why would that have been the trigger? But I think it's because he knew that this is not what they had.
That he knew that they didn't have love.
This was not a relationship built on love. This was built on the two of them conning their way through. And more importantly, I don't think he never... the way he loves Molly is different because he always had these walls up as to like who he was. Those walls, as far as he knows, weren't up when he met when he was interacting with Lilith. She broke down those walls and she was able to get to the real core of who he is. Mm-hmm. In a way that he just himself was almost in denial about.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Like,
no,
he,
for sure.
Yeah, like he thought only Molly could be the one to love him because he, as far as he knows, this is the one that he's been the most honest with.
Yep.
When in reality, it's Lilith who knows him the best and knows the piece of garbage that he is.
Yep. And it's almost like he knows that she's mocking him in that moment when she says that.
Well, okay. And
that's another thing too, is why does she need to push it? Like, why does she need to push it? Yeah, and let him walk out and stuff like that.
So that goes with my my belief of what Lilith comes to represent in the story.
Go ahead.
But well, what I think is that Doctor, she's a mirror for him, right? He sees a kindred soul in her, and she is him. And they both get off. Well, that's the thing. They both get off on the same things, you know, on being smarter than everyone, on being one up on everyone.
Well, and they're constantly playing a cat and mouse game of who's smarter than who.
Exactly. They're trying to compare their dick sizes the entire time.
Yeah.
And
although she had none.
You know what I mean though by that. But that's the thing, is that they play the same game, but she plays it better. And she actually gets off on the fact that she plays it better than him. Oh, here's someone who plays my game, but I play it better than him, and I'm gonna let him fucking know it. Because it's like these serial killers that need to leave behind trophies or go back to the scene of the crime. You know, and like take credit for it in their own way. Like they just want to be seen as the best.
Yes. And that's exactly what Pete tells him in the new movie.
Yeah.
When he's talking about like reading people, he says people, they want to be seen. They scream it. Like, this is who I am. This is who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But he said, beware when you take what you think is. When you take the con, when you are taking the performance to the next level, and you actually believe it, and that's the way he was able to, which is great because that's the way he was able to pass the lie detector test.
Right.
When he started having those visions, he began believing in what he was saying.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. Oh, I just want to just say this is where I want to just say this is where Lilith falls apart for me though. In this version.
In the 2021 or the 1947?
I think she was too petty. Because, like, after she shoots him, and she say he's like, why? Right? Where we don't get any motivation outside of greed in the original one, and, like, maybe that like low key or high key, she's a crazy bitch. In this one, she is doing this out of revenge for embarrassing him. It's implied a little bit when she's like, after she shoots him, it's just like you embarrassed me in front of everyone at the club. That I'm just like, wow, like this is, that's a little harsh of punishment.
But I, she also is saying like, oh, you thought you knew me, but you don't fucking know me. You know, like it's an ego thing at the end of the
day. It felt petty.
And I think she says it was petty, but she is petty.
Yeah, yeah. And she says something to the, into, she said something in, in the realm of, am I powerful now, Stan?
Yeah. Yeah, you she know? Does. Yeah, she does.
With the gun. Right, 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 right. Yeah, because that was part of his read. And it was, all this time, every time we say read, I keep thinking like RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I'm using it in both contexts. But, you know, for me, it's interesting because I actually really love the 1947 one because she realizes that he likes to fuck with people psychologically. So she does that to him and she fucks with him psychologically and she's convinced him. Right. It might be hard for us to swallow or to believe, but in the 47 one, she convinces him that he was a patient of hers the whole time and that his whole life was kind of like this grandiose thing. And it's he's going crazy. Right.
Which is why. So I also like the way she handled that. Right. With the when you hear the sirens and he's just like, you called the cops. You were playing me. And she's just like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I don't hear anything.
And it's like. And that's what it is. It's like his game is now being turned back on him. You know, somebody's psychologically fucking with him and it destroys him. You know, he can't handle it. And, you know, but she's so fucking devoted to it. And it is interesting because you tell yourself, like, how can he not know? But at the same time, like, if someone's just, like, looking at you as convincingly as she is, that is convincing you that you're just, like, what's wrong with you? You're going crazy. You believe it, right? People can sell anything to you. As long as they sell it, you believe it. So it's really interesting, like, this psychological play that they do in that one. And obviously, now Molly's left him, says, fuck you, I can't do this and live this blasphemous life in both versions. And now he needs to, you know, he needs to get the fuck out of here because Ezra Grindel's dead. He has no fucking money because Lilith has played him. And so the story kind of inevitably ends with him returning to the carnival and him getting so deep into alcoholism because he fucked up his life and him just losing a grip on himself and his job and everything and him gaining it all, right? It's interesting because I think the producer of the original film, you know, said he knocked at the deity's door so many times that they punished him for it, you know, and they had to like throw him back down to the gutter for it. So, you know, he went all the way up the hill and he came crashing back down. And now here he is, an alcoholic at a carnival begging for a job. And what job do they just have? It's only temporary. It's only temporary. A geek. It's kind of inevitable, right? The whole film is building up to the fact that he's going to be a geek in the end. Of course, the original film cannot end on that note like the novel does and the 2021 does. There needs to be some sort of redemption arc and moral compass to it. So, you know, Molly just so happens to be at the carnival and is able to, like, you know, come through to him. And on Tyrone Power, though, as a geek was really great.
I hated that. I was just like,
it's the 40s. They had to.
I know. But I was so mad at that ending because he should just... why didn't the Criterion Collection just cut that ending? Because we know what the real ending should be.
We got to respect it for its time, you know? Ugh. And the original script had it with him just saying, Mister, I was born for it, you know? But they had to go even further. So
I
don't know. Because, you know, I'm a sucker for this shit, like happy endings and redemption and stuff like that. But I just felt that moment, too, like, when she was, I felt moved by that moment when she reaches out to him. And it's like, that even though he doesn't, in quotation, doesn't deserve the salvation that she's about to offer, the fact that she is offering it gives more testimony on who she is.
Than who he is.
And also the saving grace.
Yeah.
It's the saving grace moment, you know? And maybe he'll end up like Pete. And she like Xena taking care of Pete.
Yeah,
and Molly will take care of Stan, you know, dealing with this alcoholism, and they'll get by trying to figure things out. But she'll ultimately be the one who will be taking care of him, you know, the fallen star.
Yeah.
But is that moment where she's like, and it's that moment where he is going to cross over to being a beast. And she brings his humanity back by her love for him.
So, I mean, I get it. I get it.
I actually, and when we talked about it yesterday, I actually liked that. It made me appreciate the ending a little bit more, especially when you see the parallels between him and Pete. But, you know, ultimately, I think Stan, both versions, is a piece of shit, deserves to be a geek. And I think that's maybe there's a little more, obviously, there's more tragedy in Guillermo del Toro's ending. But I think it's played out really well in the performance here because we finally see Stan accepting who he is, right? He's no longer chasing after that. He's no longer chasing to be important. He's just accepted that he is garbage.
You know? Yeah, you know, it's, and it's so interesting because you could take this whole story and you could take so many different interpretations from it. You know, is it just like this whole man trying to escape the fact, like a pre-writ destiny for him that he was always supposed to be a geek, you know, who he was? You know, is it kind of like a person being punished for trying to mess with the gods? Is it a commentary on the American dream? I mean, you can take so many different things from what this is trying to, what the story is about, you know, why tell this story? And I think any read on it is effective. And I think overall, it's just, it's dark and it's cynical. And I will say that the 2021 also really did show the danger of spook shows and why people shouldn't go around saying that they communicate with the dead, especially with the married couple. And they were able to show that violence. Couple, yeah, they were able to show that violence that they couldn't in the 1947 one, where he's convinced the mother of a deceased son, you know, that they will be reunited. So she commits murder-suicide on her and her husband so that they can be reunited. And that's just devastating because, you know, who fucking knows what happens when they die? But it's definitely not what you say, buddy boy. So, yeah. So it sucks because we said that this film flopped, right? If you're listening to this episode then the week that it's released, it might be playing in one of your theaters. And if you're listening to this episode all the way to the end and you haven't seen the movie, sorry for spoiling it for you, but you should go see it. Because overall, did you enjoy the film?
Me?
Did you enjoy both films, either or film?
Yeah, I think... I enjoyed the 2021 version. I think I might have enjoyed the 1947 one a little bit better. I know. Wow. Nicole,
what a victory. I was pushing for this film so hard.
It has all their traits. You love your carnivals and you love your little psychics and tarot readings. Like, this is a Nicole movie.
Audiences don't know this, but Nicole introduced us to that like freak show movie. What's it called?
Freaks.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. And so as soon as we saw the first one, we're like, what is it with Nicole and carnivals? My God.
Yeah, my all-time favorite filmmaker, Federico Fellini, a lot of his films take place in that kind of circus carnival environment. Very, very drawn to stories about people like that. But anyway, enough about that. So did you like the 1941, 47 film better? Did you think this remake was necessary?
Oh, I actually do think it was necessary, though, because otherwise I don't think anyone would have known about the 1947 one.
Interesting.
Shockingly, though, like, it's not... Even though this is a remake, you don't get that word a lot with this movie. Because technically, it's an adaptation of a book, but yeah, it is still
it's a second adaptation.
It is a remake of the original one because, yeah. So, if only for that reason. I did enjoy it. I enjoyed the new one. I thought it was good at times. I think my only beef was just like how much weaker the... That's the wrong word. I didn't enjoy the performances of the women as much as I did in the original one. I think Zima had a lot more screen time in the original one, and she was cool character, right? I think she was flawed, but she was also so endearing, right?
Yeah.
And she
had
just
didn't give Toni Collette enough screen time. It's like
and it's a shame.
It is
a shame because Toni Collette deserves.
She's
a lot
fantastic.
Of
yeah.
Oh, I wonder because Eddie had read that this was supposed to be like a 3.5 hour cut movie. So
yeah,
I wonder maybe
he has a 3 hour and a half.
Those... I thought about that. I was like, how? I'm like, I think she ended up on the cutting room floor. Yeah.
So,
Eddie,
shame.
Share some of your thoughts.
Well, I actually enjoyed this very much, and even though I'm not a big fan when the main character is so
shitty
in that sense, but I did enjoy I enjoyed both of them because you get to see a play how each director took the material up from this book and you know and give us, you know, because even Bradley Cooper's Stan, I didn't feel him to be so as entitled as the original Stan was when it came to like always looking for an opportunity here. Mm. But that does later translate in the remake of this. But I did enjoy. I felt like I did like the second that I enjoyed the new one better.
Okay.
Because of the symbolism.
You felt it was necessary. Yeah.
I did feel it was necessary. I really enjoyed, because I would have never seen this, to say the truth. Mm-hmm. This would not have been on my radar. But also because a lot of symbolism really comes out in the new one. And also, like, we didn't even talk about Enoch. The one-eyed baby.
Yeah. We never talked about
that. You know, that plays
one-eyed
baby.
That played
and
with a third eye.
Go see it and you'll find out. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting because I do feel like there is something about Nightmare Alley that the masses or the mainstream can't get with, right? Both films flopped. There's no way that this new film can be saved financially, I don't think. And both films have come out in interesting moments in time. The 1947 one right after the war. Mm-hmm. You know, we're still 2 years out of the war. And it's a little dark. It's a little cynical. You know, maybe people need something. I mean, like I said, that was a big Christmas movie year. You know, they wanted something more lighthearted. And here come out in 2021. And, you know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. Right now, ironically, the time it comes out is probably the worst moment of the pandemic. Wow. And one of the worst, at least in terms of cases per day, people don't necessarily want to go see something dark. They want to be uplifted. They want to have some fun, right? And more than anything, people just love an escape. Nightmare Alley is not an escape. It's actually kind of a hard look at our culture and our society. Mm-hmm. The reason why I think it was necessary. I think the original film is great, but I also thought this new film was great. And they were very different films. And I would encourage people to say both. But the reason why, in general, I think it was a necessary remake is just because it's both the stories. This is a story you need to hear or you should watch. I think that its message I fuck with, which is power corrupts. No matter who mm-hmm. you are, power will corrupt you and will destroy you and will destroy the people that you love. And it will destroy people around you. I think that's one of the messages that if you put it in any shape or form, I always fuck with because it's the only message that is true. Power will corrupt you, which is why I never want to get famous because it's going to ruin me. So it's interesting because maybe that's something that our capitalist country doesn't like to hear. You know, maybe that's something that we just, I don't know. It just says something about as Americans, we just don't like that message, perhaps. I mean, there's a bunch of other things Nightmare Alley says, but that's a big thing about it.
One of our greatest TV shows was Breaking Bad, which is about how power corrupted him.
Oh, God. That's right. People like that show. Well, I mean, I guess maybe in movies. Maybe they only want to see it in TV shows. Not
Mad Men
2
is another
hours.
One, and you love that show.
Which one?
Mad Men.
Yeah, kind of about that. But it was also more of like a scathing critique at like media and stuff. Okay. But anyway, again. I thought it was totally necessary and I pushed really hard for it. And I'm just super glad that we had the conversation that we did and you guys liked it as much as you did.
Yes.
And
yes.
I hope that within our discussion, even though we spoiled it, if you haven't seen it, I hope you see it and I hope you share your thoughts with us because it's great. It's got a lot to say that we didn't even talk about. Maybe mm-hmm. you could shed some light on it. And we'd really love to hear from you if you're one of the few people that went and saw this. So the ways that you can get, were you in the theater with us? Was that you that I heard coughing? Write to us. Let us know. Remakes, Reboots, Revivals at gmail.com. Instagram at Remakes, Reboots, Revivals. Twitter at Remakes Podcast. We're also on YouTube. You can follow us on there. YouTube, just search for Remakes, Reboots, Revivals. And we do have a hotline that you can call in and share your voice with. And that number is
862-248-2326. That's 862-248-2326.
And if you liked this episode and you just want people to know about us, then help us out by leaving us a 5-star rating on Apple Reviews because that does, you know, help people find our podcast and help spread the word. So, yeah, let's get out of this Nightmare Alley into, you know, Heaven's Corner or something.
Into the 2022, Yuri.
Ah, yes. You know, is it fitting that the last week of 2021 is Nightmare Alley.
Like I said last week, it's been kind of a shitty last couple of weeks for me, so
it has been a nightmare. So yeah, let's yeah. end this, and thank you for listening, and until 2022,
stay unoriginal.